Good morning. Here we are on the final day of ERNL 2007. And I've never actually formally acknowledged all the folks that have helped put this together. A lot of people have come up to me and thanked me, but it's taken a big group of folks to put this together. So the names are in the inside of your program, and I'd also like all of those folks that have been helping plan the conference and our digital initiatives department that's been helping do all the tech and AV to stand up and be acknowledged. And there are many more that I guess haven't made it yet here this early hour. I also just want to let you know that I'll be sending out an email evaluation, so let me know what you think about the conference and the facility and all that, and we'll also be sending out a link for volunteer opportunities. Many people have asked about how they can help and participate, so we'll send that out for those of you that are interested in helping in the future. Now I just want to introduce to you our final keynote speaker. Jane Burke received her library science degree at the Dominican University and her degree in management from Kellogg School of Northwestern University. Some of you will probably know her as the co-founder of Endeavor and where she served as president and CEO. She's now the vice president of ProQuest CSA and general manager of Serial Solutions. And she will be talking to us today about managing the virtual library.
Morning, everybody. You know, I think part of what I need to do as the closing speaker is actually stop and ask you again to give a round of applause to the people who put on this wonderful, wonderful conference for us. I mean, comfortable chairs, good coffee, food, ice cream in the afternoon, you know, and topics that matter a great deal and matter a great deal to us. What I'm going to try to do this morning is, well, very frankly, I'm going to ignore some of your day-to-day issues and I'm going to try to push. Because I think that we're at a time and a point where our libraries need us to almost ignore some of our traditional values and understand that really what we're all about is trying to preserve the ability to deliver information to end users. And so I want to kind of take you through some things, and I may be a bit pushy and a bit controversial, and that's kind of a deliberate thing, I think. It's gone. Okay? It's gone. I think maybe the people in this room understand it more than many of your coworkers, but it's gone. The library model that we have worked with was created in the 1960s because there was tons and tons of money for universities and institutions, and because we hired a generation of library leaders who knew they had to spend that money, who knew that they had to be very important to the emerging universities, and they spent it. And they spent it on what they could buy then, which was print. And they built these big buildings, and they bought lots of books, and they bought lots of print journals, and they built edifices to which people had to come. It's over. You know, it's over. Do you really believe that the graduate students of the 1960s wanted to go to the library if they had had a choice? They didn't have a choice. At the very basis of what we are struggling with, let's just recognize that the model was a print and physical model, and it's over. Okay? 50% of your budgets are spent on e-resources. very underutilized. I think we know that. That's one of the reasons why you're asking so much more about usage statistics and assessment, is because we have this sense that you're spending 40, 50, 60% on things that users are having difficulty with and are having difficulty finding. And the nature of the collection is much more volatile. The reason that you are all looking at the kinds of services that you're looking at is because people like ProQuest CSA, you know, merge, change their name. How many title changes are we going to go through in the next quarter at ProQuest CSA? I don't know, several thousand probably. And that doesn't match Blackwell and Coutts and, you know, all the other transactions that have gone on in just the last 4 or 5 months. So while end users have in their minds this ideal that they can now get everything from their office, and they really do prefer that, whether it's 20 inches of snow in Ithaca or 110 degrees in Austin, you know, they really don't want to walk to the library if they don't have to. They want to get everything from their desktop, and you're trying to deliver all of that to them. We need to understand that we are in a time of tremendous challenge, and that we need to solve that challenge, because in order to stay relevant, let's put that word out there, in order to stay relevant, we have to figure out this stuff and we have to make it work. Because it is all about the users. It isn't about us. It isn't about our practices. It isn't about the books. It isn't even about the e-collections. It's about the users. It's about delivering to their expectations and what they're looking for and what they want to get for the information that they're looking for. And as we all know, their perceptions of this are dramatically different than even 5 years ago. I heard someone telling a story the other day about working with a student who was doing some research, and that person was at a workstation in the library doing research, but at the same time had their laptop open because they were doing instant messaging at the same time, and they didn't want to be too distracted. So the instant messaging was going on the other machine. You know, this is the way in which the people who are our users today and who are going to be very, very important to our support in the future want to use information. I mean, those are, you know, very nice words. The web has profoundly changed. Yes, it has. And let's not forget the elephant in the room. There's an article in the February 15th issue of Library Journal written by Jonathan Rothkin from Johns Hopkins University, who says that the number one source of links through their link resolver is Google Scholar. I mean, that's where they're going to go. So we need to understand, and we can't ignore it. You know, those elephants, they get pretty big. And this one just keeps growing and growing. I don't think we can ignore it. I think we need to understand that that kind of behavior is the way in which users want to be using information and the way in which they want to be searching. They don't want to learn multiple interfaces. Our ability to get to them, to teach them multiple interfaces, is diminishing every single day. We just did a research project at Serial Solutions. We hired a professional marketing and branding firm called Parker LaPlay to do a survey for us. 87% of the respondents, and the respondents were librarians, said that they feel that the paradigm has shifted. And so it has shifted. And I think part of what I want to do today is help reinforce for you, because you are the evangelists, help reinforce for you when you go home that the paradigm has shifted and that we are no longer coming to be the virtual library, that we need to embrace being the virtual library, and that means making some choices and doing some practices that we were kind of not sure we should take on until we actually got to the point of the paradigm shift. And virtually everybody talks about it as the Googleization. That's why I said the elephant's in the room. When researchers use the library, and you all know this, when they use the library, they're using it remotely. Your opportunities to take them by the hand and teach them the difference between ABI Inform and Business Source Elite, or the difference between, Science Direct and Web of Science. It's just not there. You have to deliver the information, and you have to understand that the reason they're using Google is because they perceive that that's one interface, one way in which they're going to be able to get everything. And we need to be where the end users are. Part of why I think we need to embrace this change is until we embrace it, until we figure out that we need to go forward, we won't be able to put ourselves where our users are. One of the most interesting conversations I had at ALA Midwinter, I had with the director of a library at Mankato State University in Minnesota, who has done this, who has put reference people in the departments on a permanent basis. It's not just a little field trip. It's they live there. And he gets money. And he has resources. Because he's been able to break this notion, break the old model in people's minds that said, they got to come to us. That was a perfectly valid thing to believe when the collections were in print. They had to come to where the collections are. Now the collections are not there. I think if you think about the fundamental changes in information, it's really all about the fundamental changes in the academy. When we saw in the last 5 years, finally, the automation of the curriculum through the courseware, whether it's Blackboard or Sakai or Desire to Learn or whatever package your campus uses, when we automated the center for the first time, when we automated the delivery of the curriculum, we changed another thing fundamentally. So we have electronic information delivered to us now, delivered to our end users, to the people for whom we are meant to serve, delivered in two electronic means. And so there really are two lingua franca on the campus. That sounds kind of funny. Spanish and Italian in the same country. Esperanto, I guess. But, you know, those are the interfaces they use, and that's where they get their information. And we need to be where they are. We have to accept short-term risk in order to avoid long-term disintermediation. The first time I heard the word disintermediation, it took me, 30 seconds to say it. But the sort of coming apart is a very, very real risk for libraries. And I think in order to make sure that we stay relevant, we have to accept the short-term discomfort and risk that comes from, breaking habits and breaking practices. And in some cases, breaking practices that have really been at the heart of our libraries for a very, very long time. We need to align our priorities with reality, and we need to align our behaviors with reality. We need to understand that we cannot afford to do all the things we did before just because we've always done them. I don't know if you read Against the Grain, but in the January issue of Against the Grain, Rick Anderson from the University of Nevada at Reno wrote an excellent, excellent article asking us to truly evaluate how many things we continue to do just because we've always done them, and they're good things, and how many things we are unable to do that are essential and necessary because we're too busy doing the things we've always done. It's an excellent article. It really sort of makes you step back and say, we have only so many resources. We are the scarcest of resources, and that we have to, at times, understand that we have to do the things that will move the institution forward, not just do all the things we've always done. Now, I'm reaching to the converted here, but part of what I know you face every day is environments that you are trying to change. And so I want to, try to help reinforce that for you. In that research project that we did, and we did it in November, so it's pretty current, one of the things that was asked of the people that were interviewed was, what are you really worried about? Well, you're worried about keeping up with everything, and you're worried about transitioning the library to be a patron-friendly institution. Those two things, I think, go together. Of course you're worried about keeping up with everything. Part of what we have to decide is, what are we not going to keep up with? There are things it's okay not to do anymore. There are things that we just will not get enough return back going forward in our institutions. And in order to become a patron-friendly library, there are things we have to do differently. But this is very much on your minds. I was pleased to hear that. It's really now a matter, I think, of doing what this conference does for us all, is helps us figure out how to do that. I had the honor of being involved in the startup of Endeavor Information Systems, and we had a venture capitalist who was part of starting up our company, and frankly, I hated him. You know, there's very little that librarians have in common with venture capitalists. You know, that's kind of very true. But the one thing that he told me that was absolutely true, every time I would, you know, talk about how overwhelming it was, he would say, you can do anything, you can't do everything. And that's true of you in your libraries now. You can't do everything. You can do anything. Strong, smart, motivated, but you can't do everything. There's just not enough time to do all the traditional stuff and all the stuff that electronic collections require. So on the days, you know, when you're feeling overwhelmed, that's one of the things you ought to say to yourself, is we can do anything, we just can't do everything. So a couple of things I'd like you to think about. Even as you separate your processing operations in order to put the right people and routines in place around your e-resources, please think about how and when you're going to reintegrate them. Because if electronic collections are the dominant ones, and they are, if they are the majority of your budgets, and they are, the e-resource people can no longer be the skunk works. They have to be the center. So while I know that some of the changes you're making are changes that will take you forward, please don't lose sight of the fact that you have to bring it all back together and have the e-collections and the e-resources take their place at the center of processing. Look hard at all of your print activities. If you are on any committee, if you are in any discussion, if you have any ability, starve the books. Starve them. Rick Lux said this at the Charleston conference. You know, just ignore them. They aren't going to go away. They don't need their metadata changed very much. They don't even need to be dusted very often. You know, just starve them. Ignore them. Stop doing bibliographic instruction. It doesn't work. You're not close enough to enough of them for it to make a major difference. Save the time. Save the energy. Just stop doing it. Don't accept the long tail as an excuse. If you haven't read The Long Tail, you probably should. It's a great book about retailing, but it does not apply to us. The long tail is not an excuse for continuing to put all the people, time, and energy into book processing, into print processing, that we tend to do. We have to get the time back somehow, and the only way we're going to get it back is to do the important things and not everything we've always done. I want to say a few things about some of the tools that we have now and some of the things that you have been talking about here at this conference. What do we have? What can we expect in the short term? Some things to think about. Discovery. Users won't use it if they can't find it. And many, many of the e-resources that you're spending a lot of money on are very difficult to find or very difficult to use. Federated search is not in its infancy. Federated search is here. Have it, use it, embrace it, make it do everything you possibly can. It is where value-added premium content can be found in a single interface. It's the best thing we've got today. The value-added premium content on which you're spending millions of dollars, for the most part, is not available through Google Scholar. Some of it is, but not much. The only way in which you're going to deliver to your end users all that stuff you're spending money on is push it out through MetaSearch. It's not perfect. It isn't going to be perfect. But it's better than having it all sit there and not be found. And it's better than having those poor freshmen think that they can use ABI Inform for their science research because it's first in the alphabet. You know? Think about federated search as Google for premium content. Portray it that way. For the little time that you do have to touch people, tell them that this is their library, Google. You probably can't brand it exactly that way, but close, you know, Google something. You know, kind of get them to happen. I will tell you that publishers get it now. They do get it. They know that a great deal of the traffic to their content is coming through the MetaSearch tools. They do know that. And many of them have therefore embraced technologies to make this better than it was 2 years ago. There are more and more XML gateways. XML gateways are an essential part of delivering effectively through MetaSearch. They're faster, they're more stable, they give you an opportunity, they give people who work in the field an opportunity to do more with the data because the metadata that comes in through an XML gateway is better than Z3950. It's certainly better than screen scraping. Please believe that the publishers do have some sense of this and that they're working on it. And for your most important databases, ask your publishers. Ask them what they're doing because they'll tell you and you'll get an understanding of some more things you can do with this. There are some results processing advances. Relevancy, visualization, results clustering. There are techniques being put in place in the MetaSearch tools that are not being put in place in individual websites, or if they are, you know, your users would still rather see it all at once. So take a look at some of these things and take the risk of putting it out there. Relevancy feedback, of course. Now, relevancy feedback in MetaSearch is pretty simplistic. It has to be, because the MetaSearch tool gets all this metadata from different publishers, and it's very dependent on what the publishers send them. So word count relevancy is kind of what gets used. But it's not bad. It's what Google uses. You know, it's not bad. Visualization is another tool. As an information professional, I might not feel really good about visualization. I might get kind of tired of watching the thing, you know, kind of wander around the screen. But it doesn't matter. If it brings the freshmen, if it keeps them there for the first half hour, if they'll do something next week because they kind of like those floating triangles, use it. Put it up there. Don't worry about it. You know, maybe it's not the most accurate representation of every subject tree you've ever thought of. But if it keeps them coming, if it brings them to the interface, if they use the stuff and therefore they understand that the library delivers some value, do it. Think about results clustering. This is another technique that's just coming into place in federated searching. It's a more text-oriented way of grouping the result sets. I think that those of us who are text-oriented will feel more comfortable with it, but it's another tool. Use it. Anything that helps them feel like they're getting value, anything so that when you put your branding on the top or the bottom of the screen, they do understand that, oh, hey, the library has something to do with the fact that I found this excellent citation. Any technique that will help, you should use it. We are in a race to come up with a new discovery layer. There are an awful lot of you or people in your institutions who are involved in these discussions about Ex Libris's new tool Primo, about Innovative's new tool Encore. There are an awful lot of you who are debating whether OCLC is going to take leadership in the discovery layer. They say they want to. They're certainly well positioned to do that. Or, you know, is the elephant going to win? This is a tremendous discussion. But what I want to say to you is, do not wait. This discussion will culminate in something which is productive in 3 to 4 to 5 years. In the meantime, how many freshmen will never have used the library and will boast about it on graduation day? You know, it's not what you want. So put something in place. Don't feel like it has to be there for 10 years. Put it in place, and when there's something better, there's something better. I can tell you one thing. The winner of the discussion about the new discovery layer will not be a print-oriented tool, and it shouldn't be. Tools that highlight the electronic content that then give the user the ability to be right there and see all of it, rather than tools that highlight the print package that they have to go somewhere to get, are going to be the ones that win. Serials. I want to say a little bit about serials because I've heard a lot of really interesting discussions about how you're all organized to manage your serials. Push your link resolver. Push it and push the vendor of your link resolver hard to get what you need. Skip the landing page. Just skip it. The link resolver packages today, where the link works, allow the user to go from the result directly to the full text. They don't have to see that little page of boxes and choices in between. And they don't want to. Instead, put branding over the article, which most of the things will let you do, and just save them a step. Now, I'm not saying that there aren't going to be times when the link's going to fail and they're going to need help. Of course they will. Then the landing page will come back on its own. But, you know, you don't have to have it for the cases where you don't need it. The reason that users continue to try to use OpenURL tools, even though the links don't resolve, you know, as frequently as we'd like, is because they want one-click access. That's the game. You should demand tuned links. What I mean by that is, you know, we live in a world where this electronic content is pretty volatile. And that means that the publishers are wiggling around and that what you're offering is wiggling around. And so you might have to go back and say to your link resolver vendor, hey, you got to do something better about PubMed. Or you got to do something better about Crossref. They'll respond, maybe not overnight, but they'll respond. So tell them what you need in those ways where those very important databases can be more finely tuned to the link resolver and deliver more results with more certainty. You should expect and you should demand that we start making link resolvers smarter. The concept of search in the link just should be happening. There's no reason why we have to just use OpenURL to see if we can resolve a link. We can bury an ISBN in a link and go right to the ebook. We can even, I think, maybe probably not overnight, but maybe in a year or so, we can start putting author title searches in the links and go to the digitized copies of stuff that wasn't born digital. You can use Ebo and Echo, and you should be able pretty quickly to get to the digitized copies of those because the link gets smart. But you have to remind us that that's important to you. You have to tell the vendors that it's important to you that this kind of one-click access becomes the way that people can expect to get to that content that you're spending lots of money on. Give up check-in. Just give it up. You know, just give it up. You spend a tremendous amount of time and energy on processes for these print serials where the chances are highly likely, except in parts of the humanities, where you're getting them electronically anyway, where they're being fully archived in Portico by the vendors. Just give it up. Let RSS notify your users that there's a new issue. That's going to happen. It's there. This next one is one of my personal soapboxes. I need your help on this. There is a series of standards that was promulgated a number of years ago using Onyx to make the whole cereals thing so much better. And those standards are languishing. Ask every publisher, ask every vendor, ask everybody you talk to why the SOH standards are not fully implemented. SOH for cereals holdings. Yes, it's being used. Some of us are using it to send your holdings to OCLC. It's not being used very widely. The Onyx standard for license transmission. Boy, we're really wiggling on that one. Let's just get going here so that you don't have to key these licenses into the ERM. There is a draft standard. It's so drafty, it's dusty. I mean, you know, let's use it. And SRN. Cereals release notification. There's a standard that would allow people like TDNet, Cereal Solutions, and some of the others of us who have knowledge bases to have notification that displays in your A to Z list of the last issue published. It's called the SRN standard. Let's use it so that you guys can just relax and quit worrying about fiddling around with that sort of stuff and get some time back. What about an ERM? Well, it is your acquisitions module. I mean, that's what it is. Use it. Put it in place. Put it in the center of what you're doing. Do not buy an ERM and keep it off to the side as a little experiment. You don't have time for that. If you're going to use an ERM, use it. And what I mean by that is you have to do the tough work of adjusting your workflows to stick it in the middle. You have to look at all the places where you have previously had little belt and suspenders paper routines that should be in the ERM, need to be in the ERM, and it's one of the few ways in which you can finally get some time back. So if you're going to use it. And really understand that for a good half of your budget, it kind of is the acquisitions module. Demand the data from your vendors that will help you with the ERM process. License terms, all this sort of stuff. I mean, we want to do the things that you want us to do, and we're just like you in the sense that, you know, we all have many things to do. But these ERM systems could be giving you more value if we are implementing some of the things people have thought about so that, you know, we get the standard license and it goes into the knowledge base and it shows up in the ERM without you having to process it in there yourself. And hey, what? Then it can be shared with everybody. You know, there's a network effect there. You got to have XML. You know, one of the things about many of our ILSs is that they were conceived as print inventory systems. In fact, all of them were conceived as print inventory systems. Many of them are not the latest and greatest of technology, at least if you looked at it in the big broad world. But one of the ways to make it really, really work with everything you're trying to accomplish is put an XML layer in it. If it's not native XML, get an XML server for it. Understand the importance of MARC via XML. Somebody a little later this morning is going to talk about that. Understand how much XML allows your data to be more portable and to be more usable. This is one of the places where you really need to make sure that you're keeping the ILS up to date. Put XML in place. Support the NISO MXG effort. That's an effort where NISO defined a way of doing connectors for Fed search using XML. It's called MXG. Ask your vendor if they're supporting MXG. That's one of the best ways to make sure that we're seeing as many of these faster, more stable XML gateways. And speak a little Onyx. It's kind of like speaking a little Mark. Speak a little Onyx. You know, Onyx is an XML-based set of standards. And it's used very, very widely in the book industry. How do you think Barnes & Noble and Amazon get all that stuff? You know, they don't get it in flat file systems. It comes in Onyx. So speak a little Onyx. It's important for us to keep moving that way. Buy your metadata. Consider that for the most part, now I really hate to say this, but I'm going to, you know, I don't think end users really read the MARC records very much. No? So it's probably okay if the enumeration isn't exactly correct for the number of pages in the monographs. Buy somebody's metadata, put it in there, and let it do the best that it can do without worrying about examining it. Conser records are extremely high quality. You all know that. There's really no reason why you can't have somebody giving you MARC records for all of your e-journals. You don't have time to go in and adjust them all anyway. So use some kind of metadata service to take care of that. Save your local expertise for your local resources. The other place where the library is going to be very, very relevant and very, very important in the next 5 years is your ability to digitize and deliver your unique resources. Local information, local research files, all of the things that have been collected in special collections and that need to be made available. Save your time and your cataloging resources for those kinds of things for which you can't get metadata anywhere else, at least until somebody comes up with automatic metadata creation tools. The other reason for buying your metadata is I truly believe that you cannot locally keep a knowledge base up to date. The stuff is just too volatile. I do not believe that you have the time every single month to go in and update all the changes that Gail has made and all the changes from the ebook vendors and all the changes that everybody else has made to keep your knowledge base up to date. You need knowledge base services. And I would say to you that your knowledge base vendor is probably not really an ILS vendor. I think I'm going to come in a minute to some distinctions here that I'd like to sort of plant in your minds. Use hosted systems. If you look at Web 2.0, inherently in Web 2.0 is software as a service. That's a phrase Microsoft uses, software as a service. It's really about the fact that in a Web 2.0 world, software is not locally installed and locally maintained because we just don't have time to do it. It's about the fact that software is remotely hosted and delivered to you as a service. This is one of the places where you need to move forward because elsewhere on campus they are. Today's Saturday. Thursday, Google released hosted versions of word processing, spreadsheet, and calendarization. I mean, that's where it is. It's not where it's going, it's where it is. So use hosted systems and think seriously about them. Okay, just want to say a couple things about some things that I think are coming, things that you might want to watch for in the environment. Authentication services. How many campuses are trying to do Shibboleth? Not many. How many campuses are succeeding with Shibboleth? Yeah. We need Shibboleth. We need that granularity of authentication that Shibboleth brings, but you can't do it alone. It's too hard. It's too complicated. Somebody's going to come into the market with an authentication service that you can subscribe to that, as the authentication changes, will turn your databases on and off automatically. Watch for it. Somebody's going to bring it. I can feel it. Coins is probably a part of that as well. You know, kind of token authentication. I've heard here at this conference a number of discussions about what I call business intelligence. The ways in which you are going to see usage stats available in more ways, in more comparative ways, in smarter ways. You know, how do you think that REI knows what they've sold in their stores across the country? Do you think someone does what we do with usage statistics every month? Come on. You know. They ship data off to a business intelligence service that gives them a picture of how well turtlenecks sold against down vests. And they get it back and they change their company in a day. We need that kind of capability, so watch for that. And there's a fascinating article in the February 15th issue of Library Journal about what I've called super meta search that really talks about the fact that we need to begin harvesting the metadata around our premium content somewhere so that the meta search experience is faster and better. It's a fascinating article, And maybe something will come of this. So watch for that. Okay, I've said a lot of things about things I think you need to think about and tools you ought to use, etc. But I don't think that any of these parts and pieces are really enough. I mean, it's still, in the end, all we've talked about is parts and pieces. What you need is ERAMS. ERAMS is a concept that I'd like to sort of give to you today and have you think about and see if you think it makes sense. I believe that we have reached a time in this issue about managing our electronic collections and, more importantly, making them accessible, where we ought to understand that this is a category of software and services that you need for the library. Rather than thinking about individual things like a link resolver and a federated search system and, you know, some other piece and part, we need to be thinking about this as a category of products. Some of us in this room are old enough to remember when we went through this with the ILSs. You know, first they were CERC systems. Hey, we thought they're CERC systems. Then we thought, okay, CERC system, serials check-in system, acquisition system. Then somebody said online catalog. And finally said, no, we need an integrated library system. I believe that in the e-resource areas, we've reached the point in time when we need ERAMS, just an acronym for e-resource access and management services. A way of thinking about this that puts them into a category altogether, a way that gives you a way to talk to your colleagues about how you are making this change in your library, a place where you can budget, where you can plan, where instead of having to steal money from the system's budget to upgrade the link resolver, you can begin to actually budget for ERAMS, because you'll need more of it all the time, and the whole collection of tools and services that actually are a part of how this gets delivered. So this is a concept called ERAMS. Where does ERAMS fit? ERAMS is e-resource access and management services. It is not print collection management services, so it's not the ILS, and it is not the content itself. This is a separate product category that has two primary attributes. You know, how do you measure it on the usual charts? First of all, the focus is on e-resources. The focus is on e-resources. These are tools and services around managing electronic collections with almost blinders to make sure that that's where the focus stays, kind of like your focus. And on the knowledge base that's inherently necessary for this to work. People who deserve to be in the ERAM space will be people who are focused on your e-collections and who are willing to give you high-quality metadata around those e-collections, who are willing to put in the time and effort for knowledge bases so that you don't have to do all of it, so that you can work on the larger issues. What does an ERAMS do? Well, there's lots of ways to say this. The four C's is one of them. ERAMS is a set of services that collects, corrects, connects, and controls around your e-resources. Collecting, meaning this issue of accompanying the services is a comprehensive knowledge base. Correcting, that knowledge base gets, you know, cleaned up, because let's face it, our publishers, who are people where you are giving an awful lot of money, are trying to deliver as much content to you as they can. And in that process, they don't care about the metadata. I mean, it's just, you know, they're going to use their title abbreviation, and the other person who sells you the Journal of Nephrology is going to use a different title abbreviation, and you need somebody to bring it all together. Connecting, this is probably the most important one. We have to have products and services that get the stuff to our end users. They're the ones that matter. And control. You have to be able to know how this stuff is being used, and you have to be able to measure it. I think today all of the tools that we talk about are part of ERAMS, but I don't think it's complete. I don't think we even know what's going to make it complete. But I think if we put it up there as a category and we begin to talk about it, it will get more complete more quickly, because we'll be able to think about it in a way of an integrated set of services that draw us and draw money and help us do all the things that we don't have time for every single day. Our research project said that when you talk about the things that you need, you said that you need ways for your users to search that provides seamless integration. Number one on the list. It's got to be about delivering to the end user. You said that you felt that things were not well integrated, that there were ways in which the various services that you have could be integrated better in order to deliver more value. And you said that they need to be interoperable with the other systems that you have. I think these are the three ways to judge ERAMS. Is it delivering? Is it integrated? And is it interoperable with the other systems you have? We asked about success. Users find what they need quickly. You're able to measure. This is one of the areas where I think you don't have enough tools at all. You know, your conversation yesterday. How is it, you know, that somebody can spend that many hours? You really need ways of measuring these resources. And thirdly, relevance. What you want is something that helps you have a competitive advantage over the internet. We have to understand that that probably means, well, I won't say probably. We have to understand that that means that there's a category of services here that need to have that as its overarching goal. There are some technology requirements. They are pretty much the same, although I think that a part of ERAMS is being web native. Things have to be very easy to use, very easy for you to use, very easy for your end users to use. And that sort of leads us into this thing that I bet you've seen four or five times here, right? One of my problems with this is, you know, you go from here that says you ought to be integrated, interoperable, and web native, which sort of leads you to say, yes, so that probably means web 2. And then you go to this. With all due respect to Tim O'Reilly, I do believe in web 2.0. I believe very seriously and very strongly in web 2.0. I think libraries are not there yet, and they need to be there. I think the major economic forces in automation in this country are there. Amazon's there. Google's there. Blackboard's there. But you can't take this in. So let's just think about it a little more simply. This is Open Gardens. This is the way in which they took Web 2.0 and distilled it down to its essence. And I do want to advocate for you to spend time thinking about it as a whole. I'm very afraid that one of the things we're doing in libraries right now is we see these little tiny examples and we say, oh, they're Web 2.0. I would say to you that being truly Web 2.0 means that you do the whole thing, that you understand that you are trying to harness the collective intelligence. We need to judge ourselves by Flickr and YouTube. We can't say that we're Web 2.0 unless we have that community effect going on in what we're doing. And unless we understand that we've got the web as a platform, that data's part of the software, that we're at the end of this kind of big software release cycle and instead stuff is just changing, that we're doing lightweight programming models. You know, what that means is these systems underneath are all relational. It's far easier to make things happen. That we're talking about delivering everything through a single device, and that in the end, this is all about delivering a rich end-user experience. It's not about just this one little thing and we say, oh, we're Web 2.0. It's a way of thinking. I think we need to establish something as a category so that we get what we need. We need to clearly separate the issue of e-collections from the print collections, even while we're looking at how we're going to bring them back together again. We need a foundation for organizational and budget decisions. You cannot succeed if you don't have a way of having a compelling discussion with administration about why traditional acquisitions can't have 39 people when you have 7.5. By establishing the notion and the category, you will have a better way of having a discussion that provides you with the ability to shift the organization and its resources where it needs to be. That helps you justify the spending for the tools. That helps support the integration of your processes. I think one of the things that we're all feeling very, very uncomfortable with right now is these processes around the e-collections, half our budgets, the huge amount of what's actually used by end users, are sort of done, you know, around the edges piecemeal. And we can't stay there because we can't succeed if we stay there. And in the end, that we have a framework which allows us to look at how we're delivering this in a way that really provides value to the end users. And finally, I would say to you, hurry up. You know, hurry up. The relevance question isn't on the table from people like me. The relevance question is on the table from you. You're saying it. You're saying it to each other, and if you're saying it to each other, the provost is saying it to the president. You know? We have to find ways that make it obvious. And the way we manage these e-collections and make them available is all about how we display that relevance now, in addition to the coffee shop. I mean, I'm not trying to diminish the library's place in any way, shape, or form. But the collections and where we're putting the money in the personnel, in the collections, has got to show through. And we need to do that kind of in a hurry, I think. Okay, thanks much.
Thank you. I'm just not afraid to ask questions.
Good.
And she didn't make the distinction that was a concept, a way of thinking, but trying to articulate that way of thinking, we didn't make the connection. And she was, you know, probably saying it correctly, and I heard you say it again, and it's more filtering through, but probably because I heard that UCLA presentation about the 7 versus 39.
Mm-hmm.
And I think in terms of the architecture, all the things that I heard at the conference gave me ideas, okay, when I get back, what do I need to share with my director in terms of pitching it to our vice president of finance and our vice president of academic affairs? Because we have a plan to switch to a virtual campus to provide a degree completely virtual.
Mm-hmm.
Their perception is that we're ready because our tools are accessible.
Yep.
We have no instructional presence. Okay, you want us to skip the landing page, go directly. That costs big bucks for those servers. You know, trying to get the dollars to build this kind of architecture or infrastructure that allows you to deliver things when they see that you have all the deliverables in place. They think there's 7 of you. They don't want to give you staff of any kind.
Right.
And we're the worst percentage of staffing for our sister schools and our district. So what does that mean?
Okay, let me say a couple of things in response to that. First of all, I think you just articulated it very, very well. It's all about having a framework, having an established acronym, an established business category that makes those kind of conversations easier. We're just not there yet. I mean, this is a new concept that we are trying to give to you all to debate about and talk about and float and use. Because we think, well,
in terms of because students aren't coming in, because of this, because of that, because of old habits, trying to make that shift in their minds to bring the big bucks out, because we have great IT in terms of the hardware, but we have terrible support because of the people here. So they're already willing to just, you know, go cheap. So go big bucks.
Right. Right. I agree with you.
Do it. I'm willing to get out there and put it out there.
Right.
Anything resonate for you?
Well, one of the things that you said in your first couple of sentences, there is a problem, I think, with ERAMs getting confused with ERM. ERM is just one of many services that's a part of e-resource access and management. And so maybe in the debate, it won't stay ERAMs. Maybe it'll become something else, or maybe ERMs will become something else so that there's a clear distinction there. An ERM system is a library management tool. But, you know, ERAMs is about delivering to the end user. It's about access first and management second. So ERMs are a part of it, but not all of it.
I want to go back to your point about the, what you call it, super meta search.
Yes. Yes.
I think it's a really interesting idea, but I think it's something that I don't think the vendors can do because there's too much competition going. I don't think a single institution can do it. But it seems to me that it's a great idea for some sort of consortial or regional kind of project that really, it is the only way that we're going to get really good searching is to control the data.
Right.
And we can't do that. I mean, we gave up.
Yep.
CD-ROM towers, and we can't go back to that.
Right.
On an individual basis. It has
right.
to be something at least regional.
The whole super meta search thing is something that when you read Jonathan's article and he talks about how it can really enrich the user experience, you go, yeah, absolutely. And then you think about, well, who's going to have the server farm? You know, so somebody is. The beauty is that the server farms cost a lot less. And I think that one of the things his article doesn't do is it doesn't talk about the difficulties publishers are going to have with this concept. But I think it is a way to make the experience better, and so I think maybe it's worth exploring somehow. Maybe even in groups. I mean, you know, I bet if we looked at your list of most used databases, we could sort of group some things together. Right.
I thought that was the same concept.
It is. That is the same concept. I think the problem with Windows Live Academic is the same problem as Google Scholar, which is that publishers are just not certain yet that they can entrust their data to that kind of commercial sector. I think, you know.
You're taking a different arena than that.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, that's what Jonathan's proposing anyway. Well, I can tell you my thinking about it. First of all, I think that the number of people that instruction can actually touch is dramatically diminishing because they don't come unless it's a required course. The research where we watch students try to do research even after instruction tells us that they don't hold on to very much of it. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, the time and effort that you put into it, I'm just advocating that you put into things that will help really deliver it. It's one of those things where I just don't think we can do everything and that the return for the amount of hours and time and effort that goes into BI just doesn't seem to me to be paying off. Oh, I would work on the interfaces. I mean, I would use that group to work on the interfaces. I think
there's more of an emphasis where I am on trying to build instruction
Yeah.
But, you know, now I'm on the other part where I'm trying to get the instructional librarians to teach federated searching. They wanted us to take it down.
Wow.
But it didn't work perfectly.
Right.
Instead of at the top where I put it.
Uh-huh.
And they're totally resistant to it because it doesn't work perfectly.
And it never will.
Yeah.
You know, federated search is a discovery tool. What you want federated search to do is to be Google-like, because Google is also a discovery tool, and introduce them then to the databases that have value. And from that, then they can learn those individual interfaces.
I'm with you. How do I search that?
Yeah. Well, it's part of understanding that we and the way in which we think, and a lot of our thinking about search has come up through a single metadata mark-based tool, which is not what we have anymore. You know, lay it out that way and talk about FedSearch as a discovery tool, and then make sure that from your FedSearch, whatever it is, it's very easy to hop off into the individual databases. So I think, you know, if you take the BI committee and you spend time instead on some of those things, you know, you'll find that it does work. I personally feel that putting the FedSearch tool up front so that it is a Google-like experience is pretty essential to draw them in. You know, if you instead give them the list of 500 databases, you know.
We're out of time.
Okay. Thanks, Bonnie.